You just say go.
Test. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to try and get going. Representative Fielder, before somebody finds Representative Majority Leader Vinton and you get bumped or something, well, she has the next two bills. And you are 526. And we are recessed off of this morning, so we can start. We'll open the hearing on House Bill 526. Representative Fielder, welcome. Hand out from the sponsor.
I can go down this side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Appropriations Committee. I'm Representative Paul Fielder. I'm from House District 13, which is in beautiful northwestern Montana. House District 13 is the western half of Sanders County up to the Idaho border and the northwestern portion of Flathead counties, including the Kyler-Marion area. Today I bring before you House Bill 526. It's a bill to repeal the Montana state tax on Social Security income. When Social Security was first envisioned by Congress and started in 1935, it was never intended to be a revenue source for government. Thank you. Montana is one of 11 states that still taxes Social Security income. Last year, North Dakota and West Virginia stopped taxing Social Security income. The Montana House Taxation Committee passed this bill out of our committee because we believe that taxing Social Security income is bad policy. We're a policy committee. I know you people are different than a policy committee. The changes in this bill are pretty simple. They start on page 10, line 27, and that change basically eliminates Social Security income from Montana's source income when you're figuring your taxes. The next page is on, the next change is on page 11, line 23, where Social Security income would not be listed among Montana's source income. On page 16, the change is where Social Security would not be would be subtracted from the federal taxable income when you're filling out your income taxes. Last changes are on page 17, lines 24 and 27, which provides an effective date of January 1st, 2024, so that this bill would apply to tax years beginning after this year, after 2023. All these changes reflect a repeal of this Montana tax on Social Security income. You have a copy, or at least I asked to have a copy handed out, of the 24-step Montana taxable Social Security benefits schedule. As you can see, it's 24 steps. I thought it was interesting that on the fiscal note for this bill, under assumptions, the number one assumption was that taxation on Social Security benefits is somewhat complicated. As you look at this 24-step process, which is part of your regular income tax form for Form 2, as you start working through that, I challenge you to put a beginning number up there in box number one and try to work through that program, that process. This is what we're asking taxpayers in Montana to complete as part of their income tax. It was interesting that in taxation committee, we had a member from the Department of Revenue that was asked a question about line two in that and how to proceed after line two. And he said he'd get back to us because it was complicated and he couldn't address that. So that was line two of this 24-page form. So what this bill basically does is it takes this form that you have in front of you, this complicated form, does that to it. Repeals it. We don't deal with tax on Social Security anymore. And if I was a little bit more to the right, it would have been in the garbage. The physical note on this form, you take a look at that, and that's what you people deal with in this committee. And I look at that physical note and I say, can you believe that the state of Montana takes that much from people's Social Security income every year? It's unbelievable. People that do honest work do not have a choice about whether or not they pay into the Social Security system. It's required by government. So this House Bill 526 affects all Montanans, whether they're receiving Social Security income now or whether they're going to receive it in the future. Again, I said this came out of House taxation as a policy that taxing Social Security benefits is bad policy, and I will sit and listen to proponents and opponents and reserve the right to close. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Proponents, please, for House Bill 526. Proponents in the room. Do we have proponents online? I don't see any hands raised. Opponents.
Thank you, Chair Keenan, members of the committee. My name is Rose Bender, B-E-N-D-E-R, representing Montana Budget and Policy Center. We are opposed to House Bill 526. As shown in the fiscal note, House Bill 526 proposes exempting all Social Security income from taxation at a cost of over $250 billion each biennium. Montana already, $250 million, that is. Apologies, there's so many big numbers this session. Montana already exempts a great deal of Social Security income in a progressive way. Those living on the lowest incomes pay no tax on their Social Security income, while all households have a 15% exemption for Social Security income. According to the Department of Revenue in 2015, 75% of Social Security income is exempt from taxation in Montana, an amount that is similar to federal law. Given Montana's current exemption of most Social Security income, this bill would primarily benefit Montanans with higher incomes. In fact, more than two-thirds of the tax break would go to the wealthiest 20% of Montanans. For those with more moderate incomes, only 1 in 10 Montanans earning around $100,000 a year would benefit from this bill. Montana law provides other tax advantages for seniors, some targeted to those with lower incomes. In addition to being a bad tax policy, this bill comes with a price tag Montana cannot afford. A tax cut package totaling $1 billion just this biennium has already been signed into law. In the long term, cuts to our tax base threaten services that help Montanans with disabilities, Montanans struggling with mental health, and our seniors. Lastly, this bill goes into effect in 2024, which is after the Senate Bill 399 from last session is passed. That bill conforms us more tightly to federal taxable income, resulting in total conformity with federal taxation on Social Security income. So our Montana Social Security income taxation form will go away at that time, regardless of the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Further opponents, sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Amanda Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-S, the elected president of MFPE, the Montana Federation of Public Employees. And as you've just heard, because we already exempt most Social Security income because of the $250 million price tag, and because we worry about what services we will cut to find $250 million, MFPE is opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Additional opponents in the room? Seeing none, do we have any opponents online? I don't see any hands raised. Do we have informational witnesses?
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron McNay, M-C-N-A-Y. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and I'd be happy to try and answer questions with regards to the fiscal note.
Thank you. Any other additional, any other informational witnesses, please? If not, questions from the committee. Representative Hamilton.
Mine, I'll go. Question for the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fielder, your opening contained some good humor, and I I especially like the one where you said, a little more right, it would have been in the garbage, which might apply to more than one thing, perhaps, today. My question, however, is you said this Social Security was never intended to be a revenue source. Are you proposing that at this point we are intending it to be a revenue source?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, Social Security income is a revenue source for the state of Montana because it's being taxed by the state of Montana. It's taken revenue. It's taken income that's received in the form of Social Security income and using it as revenue for the state of Montana. Is that what we're getting at?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fielder, your statement was it was never intended to be a revenue source, and I guess I'm wondering if on the federal side, those who provide Social Security are now intending it to be a revenue source or it is accidentally a revenue source.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, when Social Security was passed in 1935, they never mentioned it being a revenue source for government, but somehow government has worked into making it a revenue source for both the federal government and the state of Montana. We can argue semantics all we want, but Montana is deriving revenue from people's Social Security income.
Follow up. Mr. Chair and Representative Fielder, I don't think it's semantics. I think it's really quite important, but let's move on. And that is, you had said, looking at this fiscal note, that's a lot of money that comes from Social Security. So what is it that this represents in terms of a percentage of the Social Security that's taxable? What percent of tax is this on Social Security?
What percent of the, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, are you asking what percent of the total tax that Montana receives is in the form of Social Security?
I'm sorry.
Please restate the bill. I'm not following you.
I'm not being very clear, apparently. Mr. Chair and Representative Fielder, you know, when I look at this number and you say it's a big number, I say, well, I can only tell if it's a big number or a small number by comparing it to what income is. And so this has to be a percentage of some income number. What is that percentage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I do not know that percentage of income number for the state of Montana. What percentage of the state of Montana this represents as far as income? I know it represents a significant amount for this taxpayer that's paying it, that's receiving Social Security.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fielder, so then what I... It's kind of hard not to be a chair, isn't it? I empathize. Mr. Chair, Representative Fielder, so we don't know if this is 1% or 2% or... We just don't... You're telling me we just don't know. When you say it's a large number, but we just don't know what size the number really is of Social Security that's paid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I'm not sure I'm following your line of questioning here, but we're looking at an annual amount, you know, after the first year, if it phases in, somewhere around $120 million a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what percent that is of the $3.5 billion budget surplus we started with this year. So,
I'm still not making it clear. Let me try one more time. Mr. Chair, Representative Fielder, this is a percentage of the amount of Social Security that people receive in Montana, right? It's not the whole thing. It's a part of the thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, yes, that's a percentage of the Social Security that people receive. Some people pay 85% of their social tax on 85% of their Social Security income. Some people pay none, depending on their total income.
Got that part. Are we on the same page now that I'm asking what that number is as a percentage of total Social Security received?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I can't answer that. I'm not sure where you're going. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not a financial
consultant. I'm a wildlife biologist.
Okay. Well, you did state that it was a big number, and that's what I was trying to. I mean, this could be 1% of a number, and it looks big, but it's not big. That's where I was going with that. So,
would the informational witness from Department of Revenue be helpful in that line of questioning?
Could be. I'll maybe get there in just a minute. And then the last question, I guess, for you, Representative, is that You know, here we have to look at everything that comes in together, and we can't just look at a single policy. And so the question would be, you know, in the out years, this is $250 million. Where do we cut $250 million to be able to pay this? What would you suggest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, the state of Montana would not have to pay any of this $250 million. What we do is we just leave that $250 million in the taxpayers' pockets. It's not like we're writing a check to somebody for this $250 million. We just leave it in the taxpayers' dollar in pockets. There's a lot of things we leave in the taxpayers' pockets. This would be another one of them.
Follow
Mr.
up.
Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative, but we're $250 million short of the revenue that we currently have if we do this. So we have to find $250 million to cut somewhere. Where would you suggest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, that's why I'm chair of the Taxation Policy Committee and you sit in the Appropriations Committee. I would have to leave that up to the capable hands of the people in this committee to find the right way to bring about this good policy.
That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Faulk.
Hey, Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Hamilton, actually. I think the number you're looking for on your initial question is in fiscal note number 4, where it says that there's approximately $1.5 billion. It says federal taxable income reported. It's not clear to me whether that is only Social Security income.
I saw that number also, and it was not clear to me either, which is the reason I asked the question.
All right. Thank you. Not much help then.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, sponsor wish to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill is basically opposed by people that want to protect revenue sources for Montana, both agencies and individuals that want to protect revenue sources. When I was running for election, I wasn't elected by people that wanted me to come here and protect state revenue sources. They want me to try to reduce the taxes that they were paying. This bill probably, I mean, this form that I had that I tore up and miraculously reappeared here. Most of you, I'm sure, do not fill this form out because we have, a lot of you have tax advisors, CPAs, that fill this form out for you. But this is a form that we're asking Montana taxpayers to go through and fill out, those that receive Social Security income. That's kind of an unfair thing. If we've got a form that we don't fill out ourselves, for most of us, and we have to hire professional tax accountants, tax providers, tax form providers, to fill out a form that this legislature requires. You know, so that's why I want to get rid of this form. 24 steps, and I'll bet you can't go through it in about an hour. It's a pretty complicated form, but we're requiring the average Montana taxpayer to fill this thing out and pay part of their income on Social Security, part of their taxes. The taxes that they pay on Social Security. We were asked the question, where are we going to come up with this $250 million to replace what this bill would repeal? Again, we're dealing with $3.5 billion budget surplus, and most of that came from individual income taxpayers. This bill wouldn't take effect this year. It wouldn't take effect until next year. So that people paying taxes in 2025, when they're filling out their forms, they wouldn't be paying taxes on their Social Security income this year. The problem with the Social Security thing is if you earn Social Security income because you've worked all your life, I'll take, for example, a young guy that started working and paid into the Social Security system at age 16, and he paid into that for his whole life. He went on and maybe had a career as a wildlife biologist and earned a pension down the road. So at the end, when he retires, he's got this pension that he earned, and he's got this Social Security income. And the way this tax on Social Security works is it drags any other income you have into whatever you earn from Social Security. And that lump sum, that total, is what drags your Social Security and why you're being taxed for it. So that poor guy that maybe had a career in the wildlife field or something, and he's not one of the wealthy people. We hear that this just benefits the wealthy, you know, and retired wildlife biologists are generally not considered wealthy. So he's got a pension here, drags his Social Security income in there, and he's paying tax on 85% of his Social Security when you work through this whole form. So what I'm trying to do is reduce the taxes that people are paying. And as I said, it's bad policy. And I'm going to leave that in the hands, the capable hands of this committee, to figure out how you can work through this bill and help enact a repeal of this bad policy so that Montana becomes the 40th state in the nation that doesn't tax Social Security income. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fielder. That concludes the hearing on the fiscal note of House Bill 526. Majority Leader Vinton, I'll let you decide which bill you'd like to go with. I think the next two are yours, 562 or 393.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I have HB 562 on top of my pile.
We will open the hearing on House Bill 562, and this is a fiscal note hearing. Is that's correct?
Yes. That is correct.
Majority Leader Vinton, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sue Vinton, V-I-N-T-O-N. I represent House District 56 in Yellowstone County. Today, for your consideration, I am bringing you the fiscal note for House Bill 562, authorizing the establishment of community choice charter schools. I know you all heard this policy on the floor. Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout with your permission.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the intent of House Bill 562 is to create options that empower parents, encourage students to develop their full educational potential, provide a variety of professional opportunities for teachers, and encourage educational entrepreneurship as being vital to the economic competitiveness of our state. So looking at the fiscal note, I will make the following comments. Under this bill, it is estimated that five choice schools will be established in the next biennium. I think this reflects a best case scenario, as it does take time for choice schools to be established. But nonetheless, it does show the tremendous opportunity for parents and students, as well as the state, at this cost. Based on these numbers, if five choice schools opened, that's at least 265 students with improved opportunities. These 265 students who will attend a choice school is about 1/1000th of a percent of our state student population, showing minimal resources are being directed away from the existing traditional schools. Nationwide, charter schools generally educate somewhere between 5 to 7% of the public school students, depending on the strength of the state laws and how long charters have been operating within the state. It does take time to build those numbers, so I'd like you to keep that in mind when reviewing this fiscal note. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll step aside and stand ready for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Have proponents, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Trish Schreiber, S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R. I'm here representing myself. I have a master's in special education. I have been in private practice as an educational therapist for 25 years, and I am here to support this bill. The way I see it, there's not an area on the fiscal note to highlight the inflow of federal grants and philanthropy that the Community Choice Schools Act will bring into the state. Choice schools are an example of state entities that could exist to help communities gain and leverage access to capital. The creation of the choice schools within Montana communities will increase federal funding streams that can be stacked with private grants and philanthropic donations to leverage impact for growth and improvements in the neighborhoods where the schools exist. Community choice schools meet the federal definition of a charter school, a distinction that will qualify each choice school to apply for startup and other funds from the Federal Charter School Fund, currently at $440 million, soon to be $500 million, per year available solely to true charter schools. Additionally, there are numerous significant private foundation grants being dispersed nationwide, encouraging education entrepreneurship, nonprofit educational ventures, permissionless innovation in education, and the development of inspiring solutions to improve educational outcomes. Similarly, there are many grants funded by family foundations located right here in Montana that are specifically focused on improving education outcomes for students. In neighboring Idaho, where they have a long-standing, robust charter school ecosystem, in large part, this is due to the efforts of one family foundation that has contributed over $700 million since 1997 to directly support the development and growth of charter schools across the state to address the specific individual needs of the communities that want to host them. Moreover, here in Montana, we're surrounded by hardworking individuals who may not have thousands of dollars to contribute to the ongoing operations of choice schools, but who do have the inclination to volunteer their time, expertise, and ingenuity to collaborate and invest their hearts, minds, souls, and sweat into improving educational outcomes for our rising generations. Lastly, House Bill 562 is only requesting A and B from the general fund, which is only about 50% of the total A and B. House Bill 562 offers the option of prorated basic entitlement to encourage schools to start small, get grounded, and then expand. And House Bill 562 proposes that the statewide authorizing commission fundraise to reimburse their administrative and training needs until they can get up and running and fund their duties by generating authorizing fees. So all in all, House Bill 562 is a responsible proposal for a complementary public school offering. I suggest passing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents? House Bill 562.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Robin Mohs, R-O-B-Y-N-M-O-H-S. I'm a wife and mother of four. We've used public school, private school, and homeschool, and currently using public school. I go to local school board meetings and learn about what the education system looks like in a very small way. In the midst of life, and I'm a preschool teacher. So students and kids are important to me. I know this is a numbers committee, so I won't speak too much. I really appreciate what Trish has looked into and the research they've done and the work they've done to find out that this will be a good fiscally responsible legislation to bring forward for the kids, the students of Montana. So vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Seeing none, do we have any? Oh, do we have a proponent? Mr. Kriegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Henry Kriegel. That's K-R-I-E-G-E-L with Americans for Prosperity. Just up here to add on, just a quick me too in support of this bill and in support of previous testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other proponents in the room? Seeing none, do we have any online proponents? I see four hands raised. I think they're all opponents.
No, proponents.
They are. Oh, okay. Miss Anna. Yes, Miss Anna, please.
Hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
There you are.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Anna Shimelinian, A-N-N-A-S-H-C-H-E-M-E-L-I-N-I-N. I have master's degree in economics.
If you could excuse me, but could you get closer to your microphone? Perhaps that will help. You're faint.
Does it work better?
There we go. Thank you very much.
So I have a master's degree in economy and computer science, and I have about 20 years experience with children of different ages, different demographics, and in different countries. I strongly support this bill and community choice schools. I absolutely agree with previous proponents, and I just want to add one small note, that when you consider fiscal impact of community of school choices, you need to consider not only direct spending, but also saving and potential increase in revenues, which will be caused by better educational opportunity for children. So these choice schools, first, they can contribute to better affordability of housing because people will not be forced to stay in expensive neighborhood just because schools are better. These schools will reduce stress from both parents and teachers simply by reducing size of the classes. And most importantly, better education means our students will be able to compete on a job market for better paid jobs. They can find these jobs in Montana, they will stay in Montana. In Montana, they will pay taxes. So these choices, these school choices are beneficial for the future, from revenue, for the future opportunity to children, and for the just better future for everyone in Montana. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lindenlob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. Less taxpayer money, more accountability, and a better education. That's what I expect from a community choice school. Fiscal note assumption 13 states A and B and basic entitlement amounts will be funded with state and local levy funds. Because 44.7% of the per pupil cost is paid by the state and 562 asks for funding only from the general fund, choice schools will be allotted about 50% of the traditional schools A and B. Likewise, basic entitlement is funded at 44.7% by the state, and 562 allows the authorizing commission to prorate the basic entitlement to meet the specific size and need of the school. The analysis in fiscal note 12 assumes that all five choice schools will be large schools and will receive the full 80% basic entitlement. More likely, most of the schools will be smaller when they open and will grow over time as the community sees fit. Therefore, their initial basic entitlement will be lower. Choice schools must maintain high academic standards as stated in the bill in order to maintain their charter. If the school doesn't meet the standards, then the authorizing commission gives the school a chance to correct the deficiency. If they fail, the funding is revoked. And if the parents aren't satisfied with the choice school, they remove their children. Funding disappears and the school closes. This is the strict accountability provided for in HB 562. Also, I think high academic standards and strict oversight with the threat of the funding being revoked will result in better schools. By contrast, only 15% of schools in a traditional public school need earn a C average in order for the traditional school to maintain its certification and therefore its funding. So conceivably, two-thirds of the students could be failing, and yet the traditional school will receive full funding and students will still enroll because most parents have no other choice. For that reason, I humbly request you support HB 562. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Simnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll keep my remarks brief. My name is Russ Simnick. It's spelled S-I-M-N-I-C-K. I serve as Senior Director of State Advocacy at the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. The National Alliance advocates for public charter schools in a number of ways, including in state capitals across the nation. Among the most essential elements of a healthy charter school sector is equitable operational funding and equal access to all state and federal categorical funding, flowing to the school in a timely fashion and in the same amount as district schools. In short, we believe that charter school students, as public school students, deserve equal funding as their traditional public school peers. House Bill 562 is a strong bill overall, and the funding piece is particularly good in its attempt to provide equitable funding for all public school students in Montana. For this reason, I commend sponsor Vinton and urge passage of House Bill 562. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Pyron.
Hello. My name is Lisa Melina Pyron, L-I-S-A-M-E-L-I-N-A. Pyron, P-Y-R-O-N. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. And thank you all for your service in taking part in our legislative process. I really appreciate it. I wanted to come on as a proponent of HB 562. I just wanted to point out that the fiscal note failed to show that the community choice school structure as proposed in House Bill 562 has a certain amount of self-funding structure in three main ways. First, an appointment to the commission is an understood rigorous volunteer position, not a job. Section 4.9 states that support staff may be provided by the Board of Public Education for centralized services like payroll, HR, accounting, information tech, or other services if those services are determined by the Commission and the Board of Public Education to be more efficiently provided by the Board. So while it states that, it doesn't mandate that it be so. It's a special distinction. It's more of a suggestion as to what might be needed in time should the community choice schools become so prolific that it would save the state money to condense those resources. Second, the commission members, in addition to being individually being committed to choice schools as a strategy for strengthening public education, they must also collectively possess substantial experience in board governance, business, finance, management, education, and also philanthropy. The reason I say philanthropy is because while the commission will focus on the specialized work of authorizing, they must also fundraise to reimburse themselves for expenditures related to administration, operations, and training. Additionally, as authorizers, the commission can generate fees from the choice schools, as can all authorizers approved by the commission. Because all the authorizers can charge fees to cover administrative activities associated with authorizing duties, there is no need to hire any additional employees at the expense of the state. Another reason why a traditional school district may want to take on authorizing duties is because their board could then guide and even influence the types of choice schools offered in their own communities as a way to complement the current system. And finally, I just wanted to say, you know, as a follow-up to what I just mentioned, the commission can raise money to gift to any of the choice schools as they see fit. And that could be used to help a fledgling school meet its own fundraising goals or to promote a particular niche school that may need a boost or even to reward schools for excellent results, which is a great incentive. House Bill 562 presents a public school structure. Because of all of this, it works with less state money than traditional schools while still focusing on improved academic results for students and financially sustainable schools. And I would love to see the committee move it forward to the next step. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We will switch to opponents now.
Sorry for my voice. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Melton with the Montana School Boards Association. My last name is spelled M-E-L-T-O-N. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Coalition of Advocates for Montana's Public Schools. Mr. Chairman, can I hand out an annotated fiscal note, please?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, first I always like to acknowledge the longstanding friendship and relationship we have with Representative Vinton. She was a great member of my board, great trustee in our membership, and not comfortable finding myself on the opposite side of an issue with her. High regard for what she's done for us and for schools in Montana and in the legislature. Sticking just to the fiscal note, and I think a lot of this has to do with the timing of the issuance of the fiscal note. This fiscal note came out very early, concurrent with the introduction of the bill. Another bill which I've actually run through a plagiarism check and found that it has 70% the same text, which is House Bill 549, that's the last time I'll mention it, has a fiscal note that came back much later after an amendment was added. And as a result, there's some gaps in terms of some of the understandings and assumptions identified by the same people who prepared both fiscal notes. I've tried to call those out in here. The first I've identified on page 2 of the fiscal note, and it's just that section 15, page 26, line 17, seems to indicate, and you could potentially clarify this to make sure it's not the case, but in discussing with the staff who worked on the fiscal notes here, I think we've acknowledged that there is, in the initial year of operation, a double count of A and B. So there's a little bit of a hitch there where you're going to have funding for the school district going out, but also an inclusion of the A and B for the district that is going to then fund the next years. It eventually comes out in the wash, but you are going to have an initial transition where there's a double count of A and B. The other thing I want you to know under the bill is that, and I'm glad to see this, by the way, that you have to have somebody who's counted in the A and B count there, but you might not yield the A and B that's equivalent to the money that's going to be then going out the door. If you could have A and B as low as 1/16 based upon participation in an extracurricular activity, for example, or a student who comes after the first enrollment count, maybe starts school in January and takes a single course, that's going to be an eighth of an A and B. So you can have a disconnect between the amount of money that's intended to be used for the revenue source to fund the outflow compared to the proportional A and B at budget level. And by the way, notwithstanding what you heard earlier, this bill provides for A and B at the same level, in fact, first dollar A and B with no decrement attached to it for every student in that charter school. So very much proportional with and even in excess of the funding of the district in which they're located, because even if they're not out on the end of the frontier and have by necessity maybe a school size of 140 kids, you can create charter schools of any size. There's no size limits in here, and you're allowing under the terms of the bill the Charter School Commission to decide how much money they need. It's a complete delegation of the authority all the way up to 80% of a $300,000+ basic entitlement at the high school, $150,000, I think, at the middle school, and $100,000 at the elementary level. So full discretion, no sideboards on the commission making that decision. I do think on page 3, as I've noted there, that with a full exemption from virtually every regulatory structure that would slow things down, including building codes, there's lots of things out there that can slow the wheels of progress down in a regulatory way, and this bill completely removes all of those provisions in Title 20, local rules, Board of Public Ed. So I think you might actually have more, but I don't know. And honestly, I don't know whether this is right or whether the other fiscal note is right either. I'm struck by the fact that you have fiscal note number 43 in the other bill, which I pasted at the bottom here, that was added after that amendment, but is equally applicable here, and that is that due to the unpredictability of future determination for the creation of these public charter schools and other unknown variables for the creation of public charter schools in general, it's noted that costs associated will be varied and are not able to be captured with any reasonable degree of accuracy. The fiscal note is provided to express possible scenarios provided by the potential of this bill as amended. And might put a dent in the side of the bill that I helped draft and like, but I have to acknowledge I can do the math on this and show you very quickly how you'll spend $15 million, 20 schools across the state located in the AA community schools with a basic entitlement that goes with each and every one of them, and you could be 20 times easily the amount that's identified in here, and likewise for the other competing bill. So if you wanted some predictability from an appropriation standpoint, maybe you put in a cap that says the projections in the fiscal note are mandatory. And if it goes beyond, then you defer funding for a future legislature. We've done that before, or rather you have, many times. I could give you examples if you care, and I won't bother you with it now. However, last but not least, there's nothing in this fiscal note that identifies any necessity of staff at the state level, even though the exact same agency will be performing the exact same duties under this bill as they are under the other bill. And on the last page there, I've identified for you, and maybe another easy fix here, but you've identified competing language in this bill by saying that this independent charter school commission is subject to the general supervision of the Board of Public Education, but they're administratively attached to them. Some of you know me from my earlier years when I served about every professional and occupational licensing board in the state that was administratively attached to the Department of Commerce, and you probably remember some of the times when we told them what to do when they tried to control us. And if you look at the language here about what it means to be administratively attached, it means the agency to which you're attached has to perform all the functions necessary to allow you to run without any supervision or control over your functions. So there's a disconnect in the bill between generally supervised by the Board of Public Education, administratively attached, nothing in the fiscal note to suggest there's need for any staff whatsoever, even though the Board of Public Ed say they need two FTE to administer the other nearly identical bill. I'm available for any questions you may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Additional opponents? House Bill 562.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Amanda Curtis, CURTIS, the president of MFPE, and boy, you know, after Mr. Melton speaks, there's almost no point in saying anything else. He's pretty much got it covered. I will just put on the record that MFPE opposes this bill and the fiscal note because it defunds public education. As you can see, you have a constitutional commitment to provide a free, quality public schools for every kid, and urge you to consider this fiscal note and in weighing that commitment. The fiscal note points to state funding and local levies increasing. The technical notes direct OPI to fund 80% of full basic entitlement while keeping public schools at less than 45%, and mention that funding for title and special ed programs will be reduced to current public schools. And I urge the committee to not to disregard the legal note attached to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional opponents?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jasmine Krotkov, and that's spelled K-R-O-T-K-O-V. And I come to you from the Montana Farmers Union. We think that establishing a charter school system as described in House Bill 562 will have a negative impact on funding for rural public schools. Charter schools do not serve urban and rural students equally, and have been shown to underserve students with disabilities and special needs, which is a particular need in rural schools, having those children get what they need. The fiscal note attached to this bill, thank you, Mr. Melton, for explaining it in such detail, like so I don't have to do that amount of detail. The fiscal note attached to the bill costs for establishing average charter schools. That average cost is disproportionate to the actual cost to rural schools. Pulling 5 or 10 students out of a public school and sending that funding to a charter school could easily collapse the funding for the public school in a rural area. This bill will undermine and underfund our public schools. And certainly some private schools are great schools. We have no doubt that in urban areas, charter schools can be effective and economically viable. However, in rural areas, charter schools face some real challenges. Montana's farm and ranch communities simply have too few K through 12 students to sustain an additional school, and the additional schools can and do affect the enrollment of local school districts and their budgets. We urge this committee to instead work toward providing the funding called for in this fiscal note to funding public schools to guarantee educational opportunity for rural public schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Murnan Butcher, last name Murnanebutcher, and I am the Deputy Director of Montanans Organized for Education, which is a group of parents and community members that cares deeply about our public schools. To echo the last speaker, we are particularly concerned with the financial implications for rural schools and how that could impact students with disabilities and families in these communities. Many of these fiscal impacts are left absent from your fiscal note. The Board of Trustees for a charter school could now be independent of the local Board of Trustees and does not have to be elected locally. Parents and community members would be paying taxes to a local charter school without the ability to elect the governing board. Community members and parents deserve a say in those governing their public schools. In this bill, traditional public schools can be converted to charter schools, and the bill also states that a charter school could be the only public school in an area. However, a school district may not require a student enrolled in the district to attend a choice school. So what happens to the previous students of these public schools when their school suddenly becomes a charter school, especially in a rural community where it might become the only school? Even if they are given preferential enrollment, what if a parent doesn't want their child to attend a school with less accountability than a traditional public school? This could cause an influx of students to neighboring schools, causing additional costs to those districts. The bill also states that a charter school must present a plan for identifying and successfully serving students with disabilities, but also that a public charter school may be organized for a special emphasis, theme, or concept. So are these public charter schools really required to admit all students, like non-charter public schools? Parents of students with disabilities are concerned about a lack of services available to them, especially if a charter school is the only one available in their area. And if and when some of these choice schools are not renewed, as charter schools across the country have been proven to be unstable, the burden to re-enroll students will fall back on traditional public schools in the district. Since A and B funding is based on the previous year, will these schools be compensated properly and given fair warning to re-expand services? Parents are concerned about the lack of financial stability for their neighborhood schools. Additionally, how will public schools losing A and B funding be supported in this loss of funding while still needing to provide services for their existing students? Students will be left behind in existing public schools with less funding. When a student leaves a neighborhood school to attend a charter school, public funding for that student leaves with the student, but nearly all costs remain behind, such as custodians, utilities, school counselors, etc. Some of these funds, especially for rural students, could be going to for-profit, unregulated, virtual charter schools that might not even be in our state. Parents want their local schools to be fully funded, especially our already cash-strapped rural schools that are the economic and social hearts of their communities. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tal Golden, T-A-L-G-O-L-D-I-N. I'm the supervising attorney for Education, Employment, and Benefits at Disability Rights Montana. Our organization serves the 250,000 adults and 21,000 school-age youth with disabilities across the state. I won't repeat what's been said on this bill. All points are valid. This will dilute our public schools, to say the least. The question that I have in my mind is Montana has 400 school districts. Where are the teachers going to come from? Most of these schools, many schools across Montana, have longstanding vacancies in their special education departments. They can't fill the seats they already have. So where are we coming up with additional teachers to teach in these new additions to the Montana school environment? Charter schools might work in New York City, where you've got 8.5 million people living in an area the size of Missoula County, and a myriad of universities cranking out special education teachers and other educators every year. But we don't have that landscape in Montana. We've got schools that are spread out across a vast rural distance, and they can't meet their existing obligations. And even in the East Coast, in Pennsylvania in particular, where there's been an experiment in charter schools, many of the charter schools failed, and there was extensive litigation in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals and the Federal Third Circuit, which covers that area, about what happens when a charter school fails. And the conclusion of those cases is that when the charter school fails and they have ongoing and outstanding obligations to special education students under IDEA, either the district of residence picks up the bag, or the state picks up the bag and has to pay those settlement agreements for failure of provision of a free appropriate public education. So again, I wonder where that money's coming from. With that, I will thank the committee for their time, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Further opponents? Seeing none, do we have opponents online? Ms. Farrell?
Yes, I'm here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm just getting to my testimony. My name is Mindy Farrell, F-E-R-R-E-L-L. I'm a retired rural public school teacher of these same rural public schools that are being expressed here today, and many people who are present here echo and are concerned about the school that I worked in for 25 rewarding years in northwestern Montana. I am not against charter schools. I am not against homeschooling. I am not personally against personal choice schools. Parents should have the freedom of choice. However, I'm hugely against public funding of these paths of education. The schools mentioned in this bill are not held to the same accreditation standards for curriculum, for instructors, or for student achievement. They are not held to the same standards that require acceptance of all students, no matter their educational needs, their physical abilities or limitations, their religious alliance, and need not be held accountable to non-discriminatory policies. These schools can pick and choose whom they will serve. Until the standards and policies are open and equal, public monies should not be directed to private education of any kind. Public monies should be distributed fairly with equal requirements and responsibilities. Freedom ends when individual rights and choice infringe upon others. Our state responsibilities remain to have a fair and a complete education for all. This funding would take away and would infringe upon rural schools by reducing those monies available to a fully accountable, accredited, and open public education system. This bill will especially undermine and underfund our public schools in rural areas. I urge you to vote no on HB 62. Do not put yet another nail into Montana's public education system, particularly our overburdened rural systems. Thank you for this opportunity to comment and for your legislative service.
Thank you. I don't see any other hands raised online. Do we have any informational witnesses?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R. I'm a budget analyst for the Office of Public Instruction and may be able to help with the questions associated with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is McCall Flynn, last name spelled F-L-Y-N-N. I'm the executive director at the Board of Public Education. Just want to say Mr. Melton is not wrong. You do not see an ask from the Board of Public Education in the fiscal note that's in front of you. We have been in discussions with the governor's budget office to get that corrected. Nonetheless, there are things that the board is going to need in terms of resources to fulfill some of the duties, so I'm happy to speak to any of those. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Majority Leader Vinton, my district includes Granite County, which has a population of roughly 3,300. And it's got two small high schools in Drummond and Phillipsburg with, say, in a ballpark number between 60 and 70 students each. Now, for the sake of argument, let's assume that in one of those communities, several families got together and had a total of 10 students, and they were interested in pursuing this charter school option. Can you kind of give me a brief description of kind of the process that they would go through to create a charter school?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In order, we would need to dive into the policy of the bill, Mr. Chairman. If a group of community members, parents, wanted to form a community choice charter school, they would apply and request to be authorized to do so. That authorization comes from the Board of Public Ed. Moving on, they would then form the as authorizers to start the school for whatever purpose they decide they need a charter school for, and they would set about raising funds, as you heard, mainly through philanthropy, to put this school together. And then as they accept students, they would form a board of trustees made up of parents and other folks that are associated with that particular charter school. Does that answer your question?
Yes, follow-up.
Follow-up.
And then once the school has been established and the students are ready to enroll, then as I understand it, some portion of the A and B money or in the like that was raised at the district would then transfer over to that facility or that school. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that's correct. Although the school of residence, which would be the school that these students are coming from, would no longer be educating those students, they would still be receiving some of that A and B.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Falk.
Mr. Vice Chair, question for the bill sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vinton. I've heard that the argument made that kids would be disallowed in these charter schools. Can you comment to that? Is there, what would be these charter schools' policy for acceptance of students?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for the question. If you would turn to page 17 of the bill, you will note under section 11, line 15, a community choice school must be open to any student residing in the state. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, it does. One follow-up here.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vinton, thank you. I also heard from some testimony today that Private schools are great schools. This is from a opponent, and I'm wondering. Another individual said that as far as the accountability piece, this is where I'm going. That only 25% of kids need a C average, and I hope I got that number right, or better for the public schools to receive full funding. I mean, if that's the case, the bar seems fairly low for this accountability. Do you know that, or can you comment on that? Is that your area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know, but I will say anecdotally that all four of my children attended public schools. We were very pleased with the education they received, and I think that it varies from school to school.
Fair enough. I just was wondering what kind of accountability standard the charter schools would be held to in light of that. But if maybe that's something that needs to be worked out yet in the bill, or is there something for that already?
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chairman and Representative. In terms of accountability, I think the accountability comes from the parents who determined to send their children there. And, you know, as we said, the school, the charter schools would rely on fundraising and be relying upon involvement of parents. And I would say that if they are not doing a good job, then parents won't want to send their children there.
That's fair, Representative. I've got a fair amount of experience with private schools, and that's my experience as well. Is if the quality of the product is deficient, then people will object and go away. And if it's not, then they stay. And it's been my experience with private schools has been absolutely outstanding. So thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Tuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for the sponsor, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tuss.
Thank you. Representative, in your last answer to the question from Representative Falk, you referenced the language on page 17 relative to enrollment, that a community choice school must be open to any student in Montana. In a rural area like where I'm from, and there's only one school, if my school district opted to do this, and I'm looking at the next line, which says the school district may not require a student enrolled in the school district to attend a choice school. What if the parents didn't want them to attend a choice school, but they were the only school and they opted to do that, the school board? How do we reconcile that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, can I clarify your question? Are you suggesting that because there would be a community choice charter school that the public school would close?
If the public school became a community choice school, right?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Tuss, I think I see what you're suggesting, and I'm not familiar with that kind of scenario. May I re-refer to Ms. Schreiber?
Sure. Please. And maybe I understand this language wrong, so if I'm getting it wrong, please tell me. But if there's one school in the community and that's the only option they have, this bill says a school district may not require a student enrolled in the school district to attend a choice school, what do you do?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That's a great question. And I think it's a very unlikely scenario, especially in a rural area where the families are very close, they're often related, they've lived together for generations together. So if they chose to convert, which is a possibility, and there's language for that in the bill, and the reason why is because the drafters didn't want to leave the rural districts out of a good thing. I mean, if it turns out that this would be ideal for them because they can raise the philanthropy to make it happen, then there are steps that they could take to apply for a charter. They'd have to go through the charter commission to authorize it. And because of the question that you're bringing up, it's very possible that the commission would choose it's not the right thing for this particular community to do it. And we know you want to, but we think, you know, hey, let's just say there are two parents who are holdouts out of a group of 16 children, maybe, who go through a K-8 school, let's say. That would be up to a 7-member group that serves as a commission, as volunteers. They've been appointed by elected officials. They would read through everything and help guide that school both to meet their needs of what they would like and to satisfy the community. But you're right. So let's say they switch it and there are two kids who don't want to go there and they're going to have to drive 20 miles to get to the next school. That's the other public offering, because the choice schools are in fact public schools. So that would be a great inconvenience for them, and that could definitely cause issues with transportation. I recognize all of that. My guess would be that the commission would probably suggest that they go to ARM 1055-604, subsection 11, and encourage them to start a charter school within their school based on the administrative rules that are already set up here in Montana. We've had them for a very long time, and that is an option that's already out there. We've not seen this scenario come up yet. but it certainly could. And I think that would probably be a better avenue for a very small rural school that had this circumstance.
Thank you. You've answered
my question.
You're
welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Melton, if that's okay.
Yes, certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tuss.
Yeah, Mr. Melton, I'm on page 3 of 5 of the revised fiscal note that you handed out. Number 12, it talks about how they believe that for purposes of this fiscal note, is estimated that 5 choice schools will be established. I want to make sure that I captured what I think you said about this. You think that's way low. You think that it, because of what you say down here in the red wording, any private school currently operating could easily apply for and receive funding for a charter school. So my guess is that you think this is going to be way more popular than just 5 schools.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tuss, that would be correct, primarily because of the waiver language in this bill. There's all of the different things you would have to do. You know, you can't instruct students in a building that hasn't been reviewed and approved by an engineer and an architect and signed off on by the Building Codes Bureau. None of that applies. And so there's a lot of things that would slow things down, lifting sanitary restrictions on a piece of property before you start it up. It doesn't apply. There's all sorts of extensive laws and local rules that are wiped from the books. And so I would assume that a private school already operating successfully in some location could easily go and demonstrate that they should have public funding for their private school and would be able to get it in short order.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So then the fiscal impact would be significantly different then if it's not 5 schools, if it's 25 schools.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tuss, that's correct, and I think that since the bill says that the basic entitlement can be provided if the commission deems it necessary, or the authorizer, rather, if a school comes to them, you have to assume, since you haven't put any sideboards here, that they're going to say, yeah, you need it. So you're going to get a basic entitlement for your high school of 10 kids. That's going to be over $300,000. For middle schoolers, you get $150,000. 3 or 4 elementary kids, you're going to get $100,000. Who wouldn't go for that? I mean, under those circumstances, if you're struggling to make ends meet and there's suddenly a path in front of you with no regulatory sideboards other than apply to the commission that's, you know, designed to vet these programs, filling out the application in both of those bills, it looks like it's laborious. It's not. I could help anybody put that together in about 3 days.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Beattie.
Thank you, Chairman Keenan. Question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beattie.
Chairman Keenan, Majority Leader Vinton. One thing, this committee has been very, many members of this committee have been very interested in performance metrics for many of the programs of various types that come before us. I have a couple of questions concerning this program. The first is, would these public charter schools be subject to annual financial audits as public schools are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beattie, yes.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Chairman Keenan, Majority Leader Benton, I couldn't find that in the bill, though. What I found was a release from requirements that are placed on public schools. I just want to make sure that this is somehow that particular financial audit, it would not be inadvertently stricken as a requirement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beattie, I answered your question and as I remembered from my presentation on the House floor, and I am looking for it as we speak.
I
I apologize for taking your time, but I will find that and I will get that to you, Representative.
Madam Majority Leader, I'll get with you sometime. I just want to be clear that that hasn't been inadvertently dropped from here. Also, is follow-up. Madam Majority Leader, is there any requirement in here that any sort of performance metrics, for instance, with respect to the education children receive at these schools would be provided to the state? The reason I'm interested in this is the state will be making a substantial commitment of funds to the operation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beattie, I believe the section of the bill that responds to your question is on page 20, line 17. No later than June 30th of each year, the authorizer shall issue a choice school performance report and charter renewal application guide to any choice school whose charter contract will expire the following year. And it goes on to discuss the parameters of the performance report.
Thank you. Chairman Keenan, I have a question for Ms. Flynn.
Certainly.
Chair Keenan, Representative Beattie.
Chairman Keenan and Ms. Flynn, it has been alluded to a couple of times that this particular fiscal note neglects the cost that will be borne by the Board of Public Education for this program. Can you elaborate on what those costs might be?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Beattie. The Board of Public Education asked for an administrative specialist to support the administrative duties as you see in Section 4. I can tell you the cost specifically that we asked for an entry-level salary is $43,890 plus a benefits package and a one-time new employee package.
Thank you.
Representative Hastings, then Representative Knave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hastings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vinton, do you know, and by the way, feel free to defer, but do you know, like, historically, do charter school teachers make more money than public school teachers?
Representative Hastings, Mr. Chairman, that's a great question, but I would refer, if possible, to Ms. Schreiber, who has much more background on that.
Ms. Schreiber.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that's a great question. And the answer is that it varies. So every school, just like, you know, every business, would have its own structure. And typically, though, charter school teachers make less money than traditional public school teachers do, and that's generally related to they don't have big, huge benefit packets or retirement funds. Rather, they're asked to, you know, they're guided. Each business would run itself, and they would have something that they would refer their employees to do, just like any other small business would do to protect their employees. And the teachers are not compelled to work there, so they can make a choice that's right for them personally if that works or doesn't work. But also, charter school teachers generally are a group of people who maybe work at the charter for 5 to 10 years before either moving on into leadership positions in the sectors or in education innovation, and or they are already retired teachers. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming to work for the charter because they have time, and maybe they can't work full time because of their retirement fund, or maybe they're a retired teacher from another state who has moved to this great state of Montana, if we were to have them, and this would be a choice for them to work if they're only, you know, say in their early 50s or mid-50s, but they're technically retired, but they really want to get back in the classroom and work at whatever level makes sense for them as a making their own contract.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And then also, do you know if there's any data around whether or not charter schools have a higher success rate or a lower success rate of recruiting teachers for the school?
That is a great question, and I wish I had an answer to that. And now I know what I'm going to spend my evening doing. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Knave.
My first questions are for Mr. Milton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Milton, I am pretty sure that I heard you say that parents would choose to go to or to form a community choice school because they didn't have to follow the basically the health and safety regulations of anywhere else where a public school would be. Do you really think that parents are going to make their choices based on those values?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nave, I don't know why the bill would allow a complete waiver of those laws if it wasn't intended that the applicants take advantage of that waiver.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melton, do you really think that parents who are choosing to form a charter school for their children are doing it to the detriment of the children's welfare?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nave, I'm not going to agree with you with what you have to say. We're parroting the policy of the bill. We're here on the fiscal note, and the fiscal note identifies, and so does the text of the bill identify, that there's no waiver. If you don't think that there's a waiver needed, then don't put one in.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melton, if we're talking about the fiscal note and you're going to complain about my comments, I believe the waiver is part of the policy and not the fiscal note. So we need to be consistent. I would also ask you about, as long as we are on the fiscal note, it is very clear that the community choice school gets a portion of the A and B per student. Now, I am aware that A and B is not the only thing that funds public schools, and there is a big difference between the total funding per student, if you look at the full budget, and what A and B is. And so if you are looking at the existing public school, keeping all of that funding plus a portion of the A and B for each of those students, and the charter school getting only a portion of the A and B, how can you claim that there is a large amount of funding being pulled from the existing public school?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nave, let me unpack that because there's several things you've said that are inaccurate and don't reflect the language in the bill or the fiscal note. It's the school district's general fund budget per pupil, wherever they are in the window of that general fund budget, that is funded to the charter school. So I'm not quite tracking with what you're saying. The general fund budget money that a student gets that's in a charter school that's pulled out of the school district of residence is at least as much, if not more, because it doesn't have a decrement, depending upon where you're at. If you're in a large community where presumably some of these charter schools would pop up, you get first dollar A and B. And so you don't take off the 50 cents or the 40 cents for each additional student until you run out of 200 or 400 below that deficit level. And there's provision in the bill for a portion of all the other general fund entitlements. So it's really general fund budget per A and B on par with what the school district from which you're coming gets. And on top of that, an extra basic entitlement.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melton, would you tell me how much that general fund entitlement per student is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nave, do you mean on a statewide basis? What's the general fund budget per pupil, or
yes.
What are you talking about? The last time I looked at this and calculated it out of the OPI budget file for FY23, the funding, if you assume a basic entitlement for schools of reasonable measure, I didn't suggest that there would be 10 or 5 or 6, which is allowed under the bill, but just actually took the A and B thresholds from the other bill, which are set at approximately 143 kids in a K-12 system. It came out to about $2,700 more per pupil than the statewide general fund budget per pupil. I can do that calculation for you and send it to the committee later today.
Mr. Chair, follow-up, Mr. Melton, I would appreciate that because you did not answer my question. I would like to redirect for just a second to Representative Beatty across from me.
Representative Beatty, or
Mr. Chairman, can I step down?
Thank you. Yes, please.
You.
Representative Beatty, would you yield?
Sure.
Representative Beatty, I know you and I have discussed this before, and I'm pretty sure that you know what the cost per student, generally speaking, a cost per student across the state for public schools is.
Representative Dave, I must confess that my memory sometimes does not serve me, and I usually have to check my notes. So I'm not going to hazard a guess because I don't want to put an incorrect number out here.
Okay.
So I won't.
Okay, I'll accept that. Thank you. I have one more question for Mr. Melton.
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dave.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton, why do you think parents would choose to go to the work of establishing and continuing a community choice school?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nave, I can't imagine which group of parents are you talking about? Just hypothetically, or?
Any group of parents who would start a school.
In order to serve their kids well.
Excuse me? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Representative Cafaro.
The hearing is not on a policy, so I object to the line of questioning. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm finished with my questions for Mr. Melton. I have one more question, and that is for Paul Taylor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neen.
Mr. Taylor, have you seen the comments to the fiscal note that were provided by Mr. Melton?
I've just been handed a copy as I walked in the door. I haven't had a chance to review it in detail, but yes, I have taken a brief look.
Follow it, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask you if you could comment on that, and so I don't know if you've looked at it well enough to do that, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Nave, in review of the comments, I would say this, and I'm going to say something similar to what I said in the hearing for a different charter bill that was heard this session. You may make note of an assumption that is assumption number 15 of the marked up fiscal note. When we drafted these two fiscal notes associated with charter schools, these are unprecedented situations, and so there is no standard by which we have the ability to make a measure to determine how many charters there should be. So we did our best effort to make a view that would show the variety of situations that could possibly be developed out of this. We're uncertain as to the actual cost associated with the development of charters in this state, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cafaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Melton, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cafaro.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Melton, on page 4 of the fiscal note, technical note number 3, it's somewhere in all of this discussion or in the bill, there was reference to a governing board or governing body. Talking about it. I didn't think it was the Board of Public Ed. But anyway, can you...
Number three.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So to me, it's not, when you look at that, it's not clear to me. This technical note says no requirements for production of trustees' financial summaries, et cetera, et cetera. Who would do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cafaro, the entirety of the reporting process is specified in the new sections of the bill that are somewhat identical across both bills. There is a complexity when you waive the entirety of a title in one sentence. And so, for example, even with regard to the local government audits associated with this accounting here, you've got an interplay between Title II and Title 20, and they're not exactly the model of clarity. In Title 20, it says you go do an audit in accordance with Title II, so you could say Title 20 is waived, you don't have to do it. Title II says These local government audits are for everybody except for local school districts. School districts have to comply with Title 20. You go back to Title 20, it points back and forth in a circular fashion, but we make it work between an understanding of what both of those bill, both of those laws provide. I think it's 27503, and I, in fact, let me pull up my phone for a minute. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. 2-7-503 says the governing body of a local government entity other than a school district has to ensure a financial report is made every year. A school district shall comply with the provisions of 29213. If you go to 29213, which is waived under this bill, it actually says you have to do an audit like it says in 27503. I'm sorry, that's it, but it's a kind of a complicated interplay, and that's what happens when you take this much of the code and say it doesn't apply.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, a question for someone else, please.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Ms. McCall.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McCall, you talked, I think you said that the Board of Public Ed is not in the bill as far as having responsibilities, but they should be, and there should be somewhere in the fiscal note something identified as a cost for the duties that the Board of Public Ed would have to do if this bill were to pass. Could you explain what those duties are as you see? So, for example, does the Board of Public Ed approve applications?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cafaro, so the Board of Public Education is, you can see, in we are in the bill. In Section 4, it says that the Community Choice School Commission would be administratively attached to the Board of Public Education under 215.122 sub 2. Those duties, I can read them to you generally, but that, in my reading of the bill, does not include the Board of Public Education be authorizing. If you look up above in the definition section, the commission means the Community Choice School Commission provided for in Section 4, which is what is administratively attached to the Board of Public Education. And if you look above, the definition for authorizer means the commission or a local school board approved as the authorizer by the commission. So I don't necessarily see the Board of Public Education being the one to approve these applications. Rather, we would act as an administrative body, which in 215.121 means that we would direct and supervise the budgeting, record-keeping, reporting. We'd include the agency's budgetary requests in our budget. We'd collect all revenues for the agency and deposit them in a fund or an account. We'd provide staff, unless otherwise indicated, which was discussed. That is a section in, or that is a piece in Section 4. And then there's a few other things in there as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then, if I may, I have a question for Mr. For Tal Goldman.
The Chair, Representative Cafaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldman, you talked about potential, I believe, for a lawsuit. Two parts. So, in the fiscal note, do you have a copy of that?
I have it on my phone in very small print. So, I will try to work with you on this.
Page 4.
Page 4.
To technical note number 3, the last sentence. This would affect funding formulas that provide impact aid, Title I, and other federal grants to Montana. So just think about that for a minute. Then my question is, in a rural area, if a choice school is the only option and that choice school has a theme, like it, somewhere in here talks about special themes, could they refuse to serve a student with disabilities and then there'd be nowhere for that student to go to school within that small community? Then could these schools be, could the school then be in jeopardy of losing its special ed funding for not meeting IDEA or these other funding, federal funding sources?
I think that's a possibility. To the extent that these schools have to comply with IDEA, IDEA has a concept known as the zero reject policy, which does not allow a school to pick and choose and cherry pick kids on the basis of disability or on the basis of their severity, their disability. And so a public school has no option to do that. It is, I would say, remains to be seen the extent of litigation that arises related to the scope of application of that zero reject provision to a public charter or a choice school.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldman, then you spoke in your testimony, I don't remember exactly what you said, but something about the potential of a lawsuit.
So these programs are very different in how they're operated, even within particular states, but across the states. Some charters are required to comply with IDEA. And just like public schools, they can be sued for violating the provisions of IDEA, including the failure to provide a free, appropriate public education and all that that entails. And that has happened a lot across the country. And what sometimes happens in those IDEA cases is that the cases settle and the student is owed what's called compensatory education. Sometimes that is services and sometimes that is monetized in terms of money that are owed to the student to pay for services that the student should have received had the school done it properly in the first place. What has happened across the country is that schools have folded, owing these compensatory education payments or services to schools, to students, excuse me, and the charter school is no longer there, they don't exist anymore, and the child is still owed these compensatory education services or payments. And what the Third Circuit has said, and I think other circuits have said, is that then either the local school district where the child is now resident or the state Department of Education has to pick up the cost of paying for that compensatory services that were, frankly, not a result of the local school district's failure, but a result of the charter school's failure to provide a free, appropriate public education.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cabrera.
Representative Wendy Boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Melton. Or actually, not Mr. Melton.
That guy.
No,
the other guy.
MFP guy.
Oh, the Board of Public Ed, or no, Ms. Curtis?
Amanda.
Hey,
sorry,
that gal.
Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of.
Representative Wendy Boy.
Ms. Curtis, looking at this fiscal note, over the years, I know we have our we've briefly spoke about a lot of these things on this particular deal, but my question is on number four of the fiscal analysis, and over the years I always hear that these charter schools are unconstitutional, but yet I'm seeing on the section four here that in section two of the bill cites article section. One, Article 10, Section 1-3 of the Montana Constitution, and finally, blah, 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 blah. So if this is kind of citing this, what part of the Constitution is unconstitutional in this fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wendy Boy, thank you for the question. As I referenced in my opposition testimony, you all are all aware that Montana's Constitution charges the legislature with funding a free, adequate, quality public education for every single kid, regardless of where they live. I know that you, the committee members, are also aware that in Montana's history, public education partners have had to sue the state of Montana for failing to adequately and equitably fund Montana's public schools. We have won on those lawsuits, which has caused this legislature to go back and change the funding formula to fund Montana's public schools. We all agree that the public education system is funded by tax dollars. It is my testimony today that by defunding the public school system to create a parallel system of private charter schools, that we will be in the same position. We will be coming to sue the state of Montana for failing to adequately fund a quality public education for every kid. The state will have to go find a way, find money to fully fund the public education system, and that will go to the taxpayer. MFPE proposes that the solution, instead of creating a parallel system of schools, would be to actually adequately fund the public school system so that every school board of trustees, when a group of parents comes and asks them to provide a charter or a program, that they can actually say, yes, we will fund that. Right now in Bozeman, they are facing such a severe budget problem that their public charter school is on the chopping block. And MFPE proposes that it would be a much better scenario if, in Bozeman specifically, that school board could say, we have enough money to provide the public education that is guaranteed to every kid with the funding that we have according to what every parent asks us. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Keogh.
Ms. Curtis, don't go all the way back, please. A question, Mr. Mr. Vice Chair, or Ms. Curtis. You know, as a public school teacher for many years, I know how important retirement programs are and benefits along the way, and, you know, having stable income. So I noticed that somewhere in here that the teachers would not be eligible for participation in TRS. And do you have any idea what would happen to a teacher if their traditional public school is turned into a charter school? What would that look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's a great question, and I know the question of pay was raised earlier in this, but I think we actually need to get back to the fundamental question of what is a teacher. I think anyone could come in and teach a representative how to stay on the fiscal note of a bill, but pedagogically, that the definition of a teacher is someone who is licensed. And this bill does not require licensed teachers. The teachers are not eligible for TRS. The teachers are not public employees in any way, shape, or form. Yet, a current district could switch and become a charter school. What do we do then with the unfunded liability in the public retirement system? What do we do with the public employee benefits that those public employees are now receiving, Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I heard the comment earlier, just to follow up, that, you know, a lot of retired teachers might be interested in working in charter schools. I just find that it's more of a comment, I guess, with our lack of teachers in this statewide, that we don't need to be creating a parallel system. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Was Representative Stuart Peragoy ahead of me?
That is correct. Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask Paul Taylor some questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stuart Peragoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, do you have the fiscal note handy?
I do.
Okay, thank you. If you'll go to, there's a couple of things. I guess we'll start with, let me see if I can find it. Well, we'll go with the one that's right in front of me. We'll start there. 15 on page 3 of 5. In the fiscal analysis, and basically the main question that I have is looking at the table above, and say in a school choice A with 100 students and which is elementary, and if those students that are attending at 50% are non-public, have not been counted for A and B, and have not been counted, say, like, in this fiscal year, school year, these students are not counted. So 50% of that, of those students attending choice A, then those 50 students who may be in private school and have not been counted, it says in 15, the state funding and local taxpayer funding would increase.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Stewart-Paraguay, how this would have to occur is that if, so all the assumptions used to develop this fiscal note made the assumption that these are currently enrolled public school students that would potentially go and enroll at the school choice. If there was a circumstance, just like assumption number 15 says, that it says if private school students wanted to be incorporated into this circumstance, what would have to occur is the private school students would first have to enroll at the public school so that they could be enrolled, and then they would have to be enrolled at the school choice. In that circumstance, then the enrollment would garner A and B. Then the funds would be redirected rather to the school of residence, but then as for the student amount, would be directed to the school choice.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Taylor. Okay, so what I'm asking to clarify it a little bit better is that school year 2023 is almost at the end, and the count has already happened, and so and based on, it's always a look back based on this year's, then next year's budget is established. So in the infusion, say like with this school, the hypothetical school that had 50 students but now is infused with 50 more non-public students, then would this school district have to ask for a supplemental, or would they have to make do with the money that they have available?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Stewart-Paraguay, I hate to be the guy that's going to be annoying in answering the question because I have to go there. What would have to occur, like, let's do the hypothetical. Let's say how this would work is the private school students would have to enroll at the public school. So let's say, just for argument's sake, that they have done that and that these students now want to be enrolled at the school choice school. What would occur is the OPI would determine the student amount for each one of these students, and we would withhold that funding from going to the school that the student is enrolled at and instead direct it to the school choice. The school that is would have those students enrolled but are not receiving the funds would literally just not receive the funds. So they would have a budget that was built on authority of enrolled students but would not receive the full amount of revenue to support the authority of that budget. Rather, a portion of the funding would be directed to the school choice. So districts would need to be very careful in assuring that they don't overspend. I'm kind of wandering from my answer, but I think I'll stop there because I believe that that is the question that you were asking.
Yes, it is. A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Taylor, then, to further exacerbate this hypothetical school, we're on assumptions, to say that then of those 50 new students were needing, let's say three students would be needing special educational services, but in 15 it's stated elsewhere in the technical fiscal analysis that would they be eligible then? Would they be eligible for the money that is in the school district for special ed students if they were not enrolled in the school district. And zero rejecting all of that. I understand all of that. So so would the school be on the choice school be on the hook to get to either find money or get private donations to cover the costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stuart Paraguay, I believe the funds that are the state and local funds are called the special ed allowable cost payment, and there are four parts to it. But what happens in this calculation is two of the four parts, and I'll just to be clear, the fourth part goes to special ed cooperatives. So let's just limit it to the three portions. The related services block grant and the instructional block grant, a portion of that funding is part of the student amount that would be directed to the school choice. As far as receiving independent services for at the choice school, they could utilize funding sources through donations, as you suggested, to provide those services. That's correct. And I guess I'm reaching a little bit, I believe IDEA would have to be provided to these students as well, and that's federal funds.
Chairman, follow up. So if the school choice is autonomous at this point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, then IDEA, what would be the process then to award the funding for those three special ed students in this hypothetical school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stuart Paraguay, you've hit the limitation of my knowledge. As far as the calculation of distribution of IDEA funds, I cannot speak to at this time, but we can get you information.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another question. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. This would be for Ms. Butcher. And I'd like to ask her the same questions, I hope, without having to repeat all of that. Did you track our conversation?
Yes,
somewhat?
Yes.
Okay.
Could you just summarize for me, though, real quick?
Okay, we have a hypothetical school on page 3 of 5, Choice School A Elementary, 100 students, but of that 100 students, 50% are non-public school students that have not been counted.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so as you stated in assumption 15, so those students, the funding that would be required, that is not addressed in the fiscal note, right? Because the assumption is that the students are coming from public school. So if these students are not enrolled and there is an influx of private school students or homeschool students into a choice school, that is not addressed in the fiscal note. That would be an additional cost that is not addressed.
Follow up. So in this hypothetical scenario, the dollar amounts that would they, I guess I should have asked this of Mr. Taylor too, but so the estimates of $593,630 would be the operational cost for that choice school. But I guess the question then, and that's what I was trying to get to with Mr. Taylor, is that that money, I think he did answer that. That money would have to be taken from the existing school district to filter into this district. And then the original public school would be out the money. He's nodding yes.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Okay, so Mr. Chair, Ms. Butcher, my question then is the IDEA monies.
Yes, yeah. So the IDEA money, as far as I understand, would be included in that per pupil amount that would be going to the choice school. I'm sure that Mr. Melton could correct me if I'm wrong on that one. But if you, yeah, as far as I understand, it's included in that per pupil amount of money.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. Butcher. Mr. Chair, I have one more question. And I'm not sure who can answer this. Going back to let me see if I can quickly find it. It's the, it's going back to the, what I believe it's in 3 and 4 of the technical, not the analysis. Yes, it is.
Page 4.
Yes, page 4 of 5. And I'm not sure who can answer this, so I might have some volunteers here. All right.
We'll try. All right.
So, Mr. Chair, the question is, in 2 and 3 of the technical notes, it says that the county is not the legal entity representing the school choice and is not required to manage the finances. This is the assumption. And so to manage the finances. And then 3 is going back to the financial summary. That's the interplay here. So 2 says that the county is not going to handle it. And so, and it says it does not appear that the Board of Trustees is not required, or that's that interplay of then who is responsible for the reporting because of the waiver, which earlier was discussed. But my question here then is that who then is responsible for the federal monies? Reporting that's required of the federal monies.
Mr. Chair, I volunteered myself. Is that permissible?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stewart Paraguay, I think I'll try to, I'll make an attempt to answer your questions in the order that you had asked them. In reference to question number 2, the bill suggests that the county is to establish a general fund and other necessary funds for the choice school, and that the county itself is to be the manager of the funds on behalf of the choice school. There's a disconnect. Yeah. For the most part, In the state of Montana, a legal entity, or LE, is the functioning unit of a educational setting, a school district, and it's governed by a school board. This situation is for a choice school that would not have a school board, and so a proxy has been set in place to do the fund accounting, which is the county. Reason for the technical note in this case is there's not good clarity as to what authorization the county has to do the fund accounting on behalf of a public choice school. To answer your second question, and I don't know if anybody saw me jumping up and down the back earlier because I really wanted to talk to this one. So here is my concern with this particular technical note. Because legal entities are governed by school boards, they have an obligation to produce a financial position annually called a trustee's financial summary. And there is state law that obligates that districts do reporting of their expenditures, their revenues, and their fund balance so that they can show a fiscal position. That data goes into a database called the Mayfair system, and it's inclusive of state, local, county, and federal dollars. That information is compiled, and it is utilized for federal reporting through two and many other reporting mechanisms. The two that are most near to my heart is one called the F-33, and the other one is the NPEFS reporting. Those two reports are utilized by the federal government to determine a thing called a coefficient of variation, that is a measure of each state against each one of each other to determine a portion of Title I funding to each state, known as the EFIG grants, which are the Educational Financial Incentive Grants. So the concern is that this particular situation would not have a legal entity, as we understand it, nor a governing board that is a school board, nor the requirement to report financial expenditures and revenues and fund balances to the state of Montana. And without that ability, because we are taking state and federal money and directing it into a public charter setting, without the ability for us to know about the accounting of that information, we will be providing incomplete information to the federal government, and it may influence things like the CV and federal grants that could be received at our state. So I hope I answered your question. I hope I didn't bore you with too much financial jargon.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm done.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would like to start with Mr. Melton, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton.
5 o'clock. I should not do this at 5 o'clock, but I'm going to. My fellow committee members really like me to ask questions. So I'm going to start on page 27 of the bill, just to make sure I got this. Line 3, the superintendent of public instruction shall reduce school district's base aid payment, blah, 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 blah. So I guess that's the what's referred to in the fiscal note as the base entitlement amount, right? You can go up to 80%. And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, yeah, K-12 base aid consists of the state portion of the general fund budgets. It's a combination of direct state aid at 44.7% and the guaranteed tax base aid that district receives. The rest comes through tax collections in May and in November.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Melton, it appears somewhere in the bill I found that the authorizer or the commission sets the, well, I guess the authorizer could be the commission or a local board sets this number.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, what the authorizer sets is the amount of the basic entitlement, which is up to and including the full amount, or rather at least K-12 base aid amount.
So they could choose on, because of their budget, to go to the full 80%, or they could just choose 80% because they want to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, the distribution of funding is under section, starting there on section 15, the place where you're going to have the additional funding that doesn't necessarily already come in and get pulled out of the existing school district's budget is on lines 22 through 27, where it identifies that the choice school must have a separate basic entitlement included in the general fund budget of the school district, and then the authorizer determines their need for a basic entitlement. So that's where the additional funding is going to come on top of the netting out of the existing school district's budget.
All right, you might be getting ahead of me here.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton, so I'm struggling to find a reason in a practical sense why anybody would choose less than the 80% that's listed in note number 5, page 4 of the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, I don't believe that they would.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton, then I think we've heard conflicting things about 50% of the AMB, not quite all the AMB, more than the AMB. Could you explain that to me, remembering it's 5 o'clock?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, and I wish Representative Nave were here because I think I am understanding better what she was getting at. There's funding outside of the general fund budget. Most of it is very heavily earmarked statutorily and formulaic, and it's a quid pro quo. A great example is the amount of money that you pay over, which is part of your expenditures, to the public employee retirement system through the countywide retirement levy, or the amount of money that you receive in return for the miles you travel. travel with weighted ridership on your buses, and so on. So if you take all of those funds together, it's higher than the general fund budget per pupil, of course. But the general fund budget per pupil, with the increased basic entitlement, using even a very reasonable estimate of school size, really pops up the amount of funding on a per pupil basis in that general fund, because it comes with several hundred thousand dollars of a basic entitlement that will presumably not be available for a school district in which that charter school crops up.
Follow up then.
Follow up.
So Mr. Chair and Mr. Melton, on page 26, the start of section 15, it says it's the intent that legislature's choice school receive operational funding on a per pupil basis that is equitable with the per pupil funding within the general fund. And is that, because it says operational funding, is that excluding the transportation budget, retirement budget, whatever the other special ones are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, yes. This is focused on the general fund budget, equitable funding within the general fund budget, the operational fund of the district.
All right. And then I think I'll switch to Mr. Taylor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton.
Chair, Mr. Taylor, I'd like to go to the table on page 3 of the fiscal note, the Choice School A, Choice School B, C, D, and E, and see if I can make those numbers go attached to something else. So my way of starting this would be to say, in column, whatever that fourth column over, student amount estimated for fiscal year 25. Mm-hmm. For Choice School A, it's $593,000. And I go over back over to the elementary table on page 2, and am I taking the per A and B max, multiplying that by 100 students and coming out with that number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, what we did to determine this amount, because, this is just the elementary. Yes, I'm going to have to say yes to that. So it's the average between the minimum and max. At fiscal year 25.
Oh, 25. Okay, I'm looking in the wrong line.
And here. So it's an average of the two.
Okay. And so then the basic entitlement number on that same line, 47,170. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor. Mm-hmm. Where do I find that number that I could carry over to this table? Is that on 6?
If you look, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, if you look at number 6, it will be 80% of the 2025 value, because this is the full basic entitlement amount. Item number 6, the elementary basic entitlement under 2025, is the full entitlement amount set forth in 20-9-306. And how that normally is determined is if a school district, the distribution is 44.7 in the state, and the remaining, if it's 80% to base, will be 35.3 is what is generally paid. What this particular bill outlines is that a district will receive a basic entitlement up to 80% in full, and that's where the 47 is coming from.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, then follow up. The ESA, or estimated student amounts, I guess is what that is, in the last two columns at the bottom of page 2, there's a minimum and max there. Are those numbers tied into this table somewhere? Is that the student amount estimate?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, we had to do minimum and maximum because if the first student walks into a building, they garner a per pupil amount that is 100% of the rate that is stated in 20-9-306. What happens is there's a decrement in elementary and high school. It's 20 minus 20 cents per student, the second student that walks through the door, and then another 20 cents off, all the way down to, it's either, I think it's 1,000 students for elementary, 800 for high school. That would be the
for the 800th student. So you have to have a range to say, well, this is the per pupil amount for the first kid that walks through the door, and this is the per pupil amount for the 800th student that comes through the door. So we had to have a minimum and a maximum. We had to take the average of the two, or what we did is we utilized an average of the two.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, so that on page 3 of 5, student amount estimated for fiscal year 2025, the 593,630 is 100 times the average of the per A and B minimum and max, or the ESA minimum and max?
The ESA, right. So what the... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton. The calculation states that there is a formula that determines a student amount, and it is 100% of the data for achievement, 100% of Indian Ed for All, and then 140 of the instructional and related services block grants. And then you may notice it says per A and B. Well, we're going to have to ignore that column, because what we did is we went with a minimum and maximum depending on where they land on the decremental scale. And then we would have to add together data, Indian Ed, instructional related, and then an average amount of the minimum and maximum per student. That gets you to a ESA amount. And so that average of high and low multiplied by 100 should arrive you at the student amount on table page 3, item number 12.
Okay, and one more, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, then, so the basic entitlement is not dependent on number of children. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, that is correct. According, and if I'm misspeak, I'm certainly hope that somebody will correct me. I believe that the whoever the governing board is of the choice school gets to make the choice as to what percentage of a basic entitlement that they could request, up to 80% of the total amount for their choice school. And yes, that's independent of the student amounts.
All right, Mr. Chair, I want to congratulate Mr. Melton and Mr. Taylor, because I understood that it's after 5 o'clock.
Wow. Thank you. Representative Vinton, would you like to close? Or Representative Faulk, one question here. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Swinging a miss.
Question for the bill sponsor.
Representative Falk.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vinton. So the question came up earlier about health and safety, and I'm looking at page 25. It's paragraph 7A. And I wonder if you want to take an opportunity to help me understand what that means.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, you stole part of my closing because I did want to point out that specific section on line 17, a choice school is subject to the same federal civil rights, health and safety requirements applicable to other public schools in the state. That should alleviate the fears that have been expressed by some of the opponents regarding treatment of students. I heard the phrases picking and choosing, and how would we deal with special ed students. Those students would be treated the same as any other school, public school in our state treats its students.
Very good. Thank you. I just think it's ironic that we're talking about civil rights, health and safety, and I keep getting emails from concerned parents in the current school system who have their kids and their civil rights, health and safety are under attack in the current school system. I know so many teachers in the current school system and across the state who are concerned about this too, and I think we'd actually get lots of teachers who would love an alternate school to work for, because they're not necessarily bought into the system or the philosophy of some of the existing schools. I think we'd actually have a flood of teachers available. And don't get me wrong, there's lots of amazing professional workers in our current school system, but I just think I love this bill. Competition breeds improved quality, improved products. So thank you, Representative.
Representative Vinton, would you like to close?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for a robust and thorough hearing. Representative Beattie, you'll be happy to know that I did find an answer to your question regarding audit. It begins on page 8, lines 27, 28, and goes on to the next page that states that the authorizing functions provided by the authorizer to the Choice Schools under its direction, including the authorizer's operating costs and expenses detailed in annual audited financial statements that conform with generally accepted accounting principles, as well as other oversight that's included in that same section. Again, I want to reiterate, I heard again a little bit of misinformation that was brought forward by opponents. Community choice charter schools are not private schools. They are public schools. They must accept any and every student that applies. Finally, I think it's important to note on page 27 of the bill, lines 18, 19, a choice school may not charge tuition and may charge only fees that may be imposed by traditional public schools in the state. So, in my opinion, community choice charter schools are a viable alternative that may or may not be chosen by members in any given community for the benefit of their students. I think that community choice charter schools can take place and be available to students alongside public schools. I appreciate that the thorough work that this committee does in looking at not only the fiscal note, but also the substance of this bill, and I would ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Majority Leader Vinton. That concludes the hearing on House Bill 562. We'll move right into the hearing on House Bill 393. We have an 11-page bill and a 7-page fiscal note. Fiscal note hearing on House Bill 393. Is that right? 393, yes. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I feel like we should go do a lap around the parking lot just to kind of, you know, start fresh. So, again, Sue Vinton, V-I-N-T-O-N, representing House District 56 in Yellowstone County, bringing to you for your consideration, House Bill 393 established the Students with Special Needs Equal Opportunity Act. So I'm just going to briefly, for the benefit of this committee, talk about what is an ESA, or an education savings account. Ed savings accounts help parents provide equal educational opportunity for their child with special needs, allowing parents to customize their child's education. Educational services deemed eligible by this act are chosen by the parent, who is reimbursed by funds in a government-controlled account dedicated to their child's educational needs. Why do we need ESAs? All students are different, and their needs are similarly unique. Families need flexibility in accessing the best and most appropriate educational setting for their child, and these ESAs help families while giving public schools more resources for fewer children. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll step aside and be ready for your questions. Thank you.
Proponents, please. Proponents for House Bill 393.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dylan Klapmeier. Last name is spelled K-L-A-P-M-E-I-E-R, and I'm Governor Gianforte's education advisor. The governor supports House Bill 393 and really appreciates Majority Leader Vinton bringing it forward this session. As you heard from the sponsor and in the policy discussions, House Bill 393 establishes a Students with Special Needs Education Savings Account at the Office of Public Instruction to provide additional educational opportunities to Montana's special education students. Just sticking to the fiscal note, you can see that this program is largely funded through the students' share of state education funding. The appropriation for House Bill 393 for the The appropriation in House Bill 393 is for the administrative costs associated with getting the program up and running at the Office of Public Instruction. While Montana's public schools do a great job of serving the vast majority of special needs students, House Bill 393 gives those families who would be better served in an alternative education environment a greater opportunity to do so. And I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents, please.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Trish Schreiber, S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R. As I mentioned before, I am a special educator by trade. I've worked in private practice for parents and students with special needs for the last 25 years, and this bill is excellent. And I just wanted to come out as a supporter knowing that I understand it's complicated when it comes to the fiscal impact and that I think it's not insurmountable. I believe that this bill is well thought out and what is proposed is very good and can absolutely work in Montana. And this is something that we need for our students. I ran a practice where parents paid out of pocket for special education services that they had been denied in their public schools because a lot of times they're not even identified as having special needs when in fact they do. And this gives parents a way to get help so that they're not having to pay out of pocket, but instead they can use their own tax dollars, which they have the right to use, in order to get the services that they desperately need for their students. It is a sad issue of inequity when you think about parents of students with special needs who are told, sorry, there's nothing going on here. There's nothing wrong with your kid. We know they're in the fourth grade and not reading yet, but we have other children who are a bigger deal that we have to deal with who are worse off than your own child, and they just are not even recognized. So even at the level of assessment, a bill like this would allow them to use whatever services they would need in order to identify their children and then get them the services that they need. So I support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kriegel, and that's K-R-I-E-G-E-L. I'm with Americans for Prosperity. I think some of you have heard that we support the best education that meets the unique needs of the child, whether it's public, private, innovative, in this case for special needs. If those needs can't be filled adequately in our public school system, then certainly the funds should follow the child, and the parents should be able to afford the best possible education to meet those needs, whether it's equine therapy, art therapy, whatever it is that is innovative that can help that child fulfill its potential and add value to our community. So for these reasons, we stand in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional proponents? I see we have one hand raised. Mr. Lindenlob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wholeheartedly support the bill. I think it's a great way, use of funds to have an ESA. I have some friends that have an adult special needs, that was a special needs student, and I wonder how much better their life would have been had this been available at that time. I won't waste your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Are there any other proponents? Seeing none, opponents? Yes, you may pass out the handout.
I'm going to go ahead and do that then,
thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Melton with the Montana School Boards Association. Last name is spelled M-E-L-T-O-N, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Advocates for Montana's Public Schools. I'm going to try to hit the high notes in here. I know you've had a long day, and I appreciate you being here and having patience with us. As I look through the fiscal note, the things that stand out at us, first of all, that the fiscal note projects that there may only be 100 students taking part, and yet the fiscal note also projects that you need two staff at OPI to do that. We think that's actually overloaded on the fiscal impact there, although it may be less than what's needed if the program goes as far as it certainly could. I want to draw your attention on page 2 at the bottom highlighted that the fiscal projections, and no, I do not think that all school district or every single student in the state is going to go run off and do this, but the wide latitude between what the fiscal note is saying, which is that we think there's going to be half of 1%, and it's going to cost a few $100,000 versus if everybody did it, it'll be $140 million out of existing school district general fund budgets. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence in the accuracy of the note. I'm not calling anybody out on that. I don't know that you could come up with something accurate, but I do think it begs for the same suggestion that I made on the last bill and that I had to acknowledge would probably apply equally to House Bill 549, and that is cap it. If there's going to be 100 kids coming in, and that's what your fiscal note says, then say when 100 kids are done, it's over. And then come back next session if there's more. But the way the funding flows in here right now is it's K-12 base aid generated, and so you could have somebody that came in under the provisions of this bill on February 1st. They get in the enrollment count. They take one course. They get 1/8 A and B, and the next year the district owes 100% of that amount or close to it. There's numbers in here on that, but several times more than that out for that very same student in order to leave and go and try this out. And there are provisions in there that say that the parent has to waive the right to come back. I don't think that's enforceable under the law. There are court cases that talk about the enforceability of a right that's there for a class of individuals, and it doesn't allow individual waiver. I do think that a more reasonable estimate of use here might be consistent with the incident of use that you have right now in private schools and homeschools, which is about 10% of your student population statewide, about 15,000 kids compared to about 155,000 in the public schools. And if you did that projection, you'd come up, and you can see that at the top of page 3, that would be $14.5 million per year out of school district general fund budgets, with an ongoing obligation to provide comparable services to students that are no longer in the public school on par with the services that they provide within the school, and with a potential impact when the student comes back after the enrollment count. After the second one in March, ran out of the money and decided to come back and said, enroll and admit me. We have to do so under state and federal law, and they'll be back in, and we won't have any A and B for them, but the next year we will have to continue to serve them without the budget necessary to do so. I just note and observe that on page 4, it identifies in note 27 that there is a legal review note with this bill. It's worth looking at. Down there at the bottom of page 4, where is there an expenditure cap or a sunset date? It's kind of in the reverse, but no, there is not. And so K-12 base aid yields a supplemental when you come up short on your projections. It's not like some of the other things you do where you're out of luck. The appropriation ran out. What happens is it automatically yields a supplemental appropriation request, and you have the right to decide whether you're going to honor that or not, but honoring it or not will largely determine whether you're complying with your obligation to provide the basic system of free quality schools that's constitutionally mandated and guaranteed in your laws. Next page, just calling out the fact that the fiscal note identifies that a loss of funding in the school could be disproportionate to the reduction in expense. I kind of outlined that earlier as sort of the perfect storm of the coming and going and the impact that that would have on the revenue source that you have to provide this. Down at the bottom, I would actually call out and alleviate concerns on the technical note on the bottom of page 5, where it claims that Article 10, Section 6 would prohibit this. Article 10, Section 6 is no longer really operable under the Espinoza holding. However, Article 5, Section 11, Subsection 5 is, which prohibits an appropriation of public funds for a private purpose not under control of the state. So I don't think this technical note is right, but there's another one that is that's missing. The same federal regulation that we talk about here on the revocation of consent on page 6, yes, a parent can revoke consent, and I think that you could write that a little bit stronger in the bill to say the parent, by taking this money, is revoking their consent to the provision of special education services. But if the parent changes their mind next week and says, I now want those services, there's nothing the district can say, well, too bad, you waived it. You revoke it, you claim it again. That's the way the law works. So it's not something that we have the prerogative, nor would we have the likelihood of telling somebody no when they came and had run out of money and needed the services provided. So I've already gone through the enrollment of the student on a fractional A and B the preceding year, and a couple of things here on the back page, but they're honestly not worth taking your time. You can ask me any questions if there's any high notes in here that I haven't hit. I hope I've been adequately brief, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Opponents, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Tal Golden, T-A-L-G-O-L-D-I-N. I'm the supervising attorney for Education, Employment, and Benefits at Disability Rights Montana, the federally mandated protection and advocacy system for Montana. Mr. Chair, I do have a
hand. Yes, you may.
We've provided a detailed analysis of the bill in the handout, so I'll try and be as brief as possible. I do want to start by thanking Majority Leader Vinton for her work to expand educational opportunities for children with disabilities. We fully support that goal. We also do not categorically oppose school choice. We oppose programs like the one in this bill that take money from public schools to fund school choice. In our view, this bill does not advance the goal of expanding opportunities. And let me say, I'm an advocate and a civil rights attorney for children with disabilities. If I thought this bill would benefit children with disabilities, I would be a proponent. It does not do that. The vast majority of children with disabilities rely on public schools to receive a free, appropriate public education designed to meet their individual needs. Our objections to this bill come directly from the fiscal impact, as detailed in the fiscal note, and I've provided the citations in the handout. The two versions of the fiscal note are nearly identical, except for changes in the technical notes. The bill effectively does two things. First, as noted in Assumption 16, it sets up a, quote, separate trust for each individual participating student with a disability. Second, it transfers essentially all public money associated with that student directly from local control school district's general fund to a private purpose trust account established for each individual participating student. Let me say that again. 90% of students will not benefit from this bill, but their parents will pay for the less than 10% that potentially could benefit. The money extracted by this bill from the district's general fund includes money that your constituents, local taxpayers, specifically voted to invest in their public schools. They did not vote to send their property tax dollars to OPI for administrative costs or to fund private trust accounts for an individual student. And as noted in the fiscal note, this bill is likely to raise property taxes to cover those losses. Section 4.1 of the bill shows that the state money taken from Montana's locally controlled public schools to fund private education, tuition, equipment, supplies, private services, salaries for private school staff, transportation, curricular materials, and I'm quoting here, any other educational expense approved by the state superintendent of public instruction, end quote. Importantly, the bill does not take this money to fund a program that benefits all children in the district, but instead funds a trust account for a specific child with a disability. The local controlled school district pays a triple penalty to fund these state-operated trust accounts. The section of the fiscal note entitled Effect on County or Other Local Government Revenues and Expenditures on page 5 well describes this triple threat. First, the students who participate in the program are not attending the district. Therefore, the district cannot continue to count these children for A and B purposes and incurs a proportional decrease in the funding associated with that reduced enrollment in the year following. The district draws down less money because the child doesn't attend anymore. Second, under Section 9.3A of the bill, the district of residence still has to remit the funds provided for in Section 1 of the bill from its general fund. Notably, these general fund dollars are extracted by the state without an election by the residents of the district. As noted on page 5 of the fiscal note, schools may be forced to adopt higher general fund budgets to offset payments. And as noted there, even if the district increases property taxes to cover the losses, that may not be enough. Third, the bill provides no mechanism for the public school to recoup this lost revenue. And the district still has to meet its own fixed cost. That includes, as the fiscal note notes, the significant amount of its budget that are delineated for staffing. And let me make that point specific for children with disabilities, because the law mandates that there's a minimum number of special education teachers that a district must have in order to operate a special education program and also in order to be accredited. That doesn't change whether there's one student or three students. So if two of the students go to the private program, the district hasn't gotten any more money. They've lost money to this private program, and they still have to maintain that staffing. So let me put this into dollar and cents, which the fiscal note does really well in assumptions 5 through 12 on page 2 and 3, and in the local government impact area on page 5. In FY27, for every child that participates in the program under HB 393, $7,000 per year per student for an elementary school district, and just under $9,000 per year per student for a high school district is transferred. Let me accumulate that so that we can look at the impact across the state, because the fiscal note, as it makes clear, that we're talking about a net impact of potentially millions of dollars of local controlled money. Assumption 26 states that to break even, the program would have to have at least 548 students participate in future years. For FY27, the maximum average amount for high school and elementary school districts per student per year transferred from local control districts is just under $8,000. So this means for FY27, just to cover program costs, over $4.3 million annually must be redistributed from local control districts to the OPI-operated individual private purpose trust accounts. Based on October 2022 enrollment data, the fiscal note estimates that if every eligible student participated in the educational savings account, over $151 million will be transferred annually from school districts' general funds to these private trust accounts. And in all likelihood, that would bankrupt some schools. Here in Helena, we received notice just recently that the district plans to close one building and that up to 125 non-tenured staff, including teachers and administrators, may not have their contracts renewed this year because the district is in a deficit. Our schools cannot absorb the fiscal impact of this adventure, right? We may be talking about a few kids here and a few kids there on the margin, maybe, in a best-case scenario, but our districts don't have an extra $7,000, an extra $14,000, an extra $21,000 to absorb. So I've explained sort of the disastrous fiscal impact that this bill will have on local control schools. Now, let me turn back to my first point and explain why this bill is completely unnecessary, unless, of course, the point is to defund our local public schools. The end of putting some money away for kids with disabilities for their future needs is a good one, even if they choose to use that money for private services. But we don't need this bill to do that. And we shouldn't be funding it with local taxpayer dollars. In 2015, Senator Thomas carried SB 399, which authorized ABLE accounts in Montana. ABLE accounts are essentially 529 savings accounts for specifically disability-related expenses. ABLE accounts are tax-advantaged, and they allow contributions which are deductible up to $3,000 per year on state income taxes and excludable up to $15,000 per year on federal income taxes. In addition to being tax-advantaged, ABLE accounts are protected from Social Security and Medicaid resource limits up to $100,000 per individual. So the trusts set up by this bill are neither tax-advantaged nor protected from needs-tested asset caps. The bill does not set up a useful savings mechanisms for families or children with disabilities. All it does is take money from public schools to fund private individual trusts held by OPI. So to summarize, this bill in its current form, it's just not good policy. It extracts money from already struggling public schools, and it places it in the hands of private programs and vendors, regardless of whether they're for-profit or non-profit, and with minimal accountability in the private sector. Even the participating student doesn't get the full benefit of those taxpayer dollars because 5% is skimmed off the top to fund OPI's administrative costs. The bill removes from participating children with disabilities their rights, specifically under IDEA, while making it harder for schools to serve their remaining students. And it allows private schools broad latitude to discriminate on the basis of disability. And let me explain that a little bit more, because private schools, if they're religiously affiliated, are not subject to the ADA. They're not subject to the IDEA. And unless they're receiving federal financial assistance, they're not subject to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. All they would be subject to is the Montana Human Rights Act, which provides significantly less protection than those federal civil rights laws. And the way the bill is written, it provides some latitude for schools to deny services within sort of reasonable boundaries, which Section 504 and the ADA don't allow. Again, we support the goal of improving services for all children with disabilities, and we truly thank Majority Leader Vinton for her ongoing work for our kids. Right now, we need to financially support our public schools. We need to make it a fair experiment. When we've fully invested in our public schools and given them what they need to do their job right, which we've never done in the history of public education in this country, then we can start exploring other adventures. But we're not there yet. We oppose HB 393, and we urge you to do the same, because it'll leave most kids with disabilities behind, and it'll hurt kids who are already in financially strapped public schools. And that's not just kids with disabilities. When districts have to cover the cost from general fund, that's going to hurt everybody, not just kids with disabilities. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Amanda Curtis, CURTIS, the president of MFPE, here in opposition of the bill based on its fiscal note. There is no need for me to repeat any earlier testimony. You have heard it all. The same is all true. We urge you not to pass an education bill with parentheses around the net impact numbers. Please do not defund public education by creating a voucher system. Please do not waste taxpayer dollars on added government bureaucracy to build a system that requires a waiver of rights and will actually result in fewer and lesser services for our students with disabilities. I direct your attention to the bottom of page 2 of the fiscal note and ask, what would we cut from public education without that funding? Why don't public schools have equine therapy? Because we can't afford it. I urge this legislature to adequately fund public schools so that boards of trustees can say yes when parents request equine therapy or any other program under the sun that could possibly be offered under this voucher system. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Jenny Murnan Butcher, MURNANEBUTCHER, Deputy Director of Montanans Organized for Education. We are a group of community members and parents, and as such, we believe that no public funding should be diverted to educational institutions or individuals that cannot be held accountable for the tax dollars that these community members and parents are paying. In this bill, there are few reporting requirements to ensure that children are receiving a high-quality education with the use of these public funds. The bill specifically states that private schools that receive tuition payments from one of these savings accounts cannot be regulated by the state. Therefore, public funding could be going to a for-profit institution that has no requirements for how they educate students with disabilities, compared to public schools with a plethora of state and federal regulations intended to protect students receiving special education. Parents of students with disabilities are concerned that as students leave their community schools, schools will not have enough funding to provide adequate services for the students remaining in public schools, especially in rural areas. I heard the bill sponsor state that public schools would have more funding to serve their remaining students, but that is simply not true. If you imagine a rural school with 3 students with IEPs and 2 leave, the school still must employ a certified special education teacher and potentially other specialists, such as a speech-language pathologist, to meet the needs of the remaining students, but they will have lost thousands of dollars in per-pupil funding. Let me be clear. We believe that it is a parent's right and choice to homeschool their child or send them to a private school, regardless of IEP status. But if public funds are being used, accountability should be assured. Please do not divert funds from the public schools and special education programs that desperately need them. If you are concerned that public schools are not fully serving the needs of students with disabilities, then increase funding for those schools and vote no on HB 393. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents? Seeing none, I don't see any hands raised online. Do we have informational witnesses? Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, Paul Taylor, TAYLOR. I'm a budget analyst for the Office of Public Instruction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other information? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Seeing Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Golden, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Golden, I am interested in the technical note. I'm going to call on your attorney expertise here. Let's see. It's technical note on page 6, number 3.
Right.
Having years ago taught in the special education field, I'm stunned by the possibility that a parent could relieve the school of responsibility, and that holds legal weight. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. There's maybe two different concepts. So the technical note that notes that a parent can revoke consent to special education related services, that's true. It's a it's a system based upon informed consent. Whether a parent can affirmatively waive a district's obligations, I do not believe that the law supports that proposition, because those are affirmative obligations that are imposed upon the district, not because the specific child attends that school, but because the district is contracted by virtue of contract with the state and by extension with the federal government to receive Part B funds and therefore is obligated to follow all the regulations.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, Mr. Golden, I see where I went wrong here on the consent part is, of course, one thing. I think I was thinking more of the obligation part, and I was thinking that that was actually a federal obligation, not necessarily a state obligation. Am I looking at that wrong?
No, it's both. So the way that the system in sort of broad strokes works is the federal IDEA Part B, which is the K through 12 portion, the state submits an annual plan every year. They're essentially contracting with the federal government to receive these funds, and as part of that, they agree to follow all of the federal regulations. Districts essentially do the same thing with the state and, by extension, are agreeing to follow all those federal regulations. In addition, both Montana statute and Montana regulations say that school districts have to follow IDEA. So it all is the federal framework, but it's implemented through a state framework.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions? Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple. My first question is, would this bill as written potentially mean that local governments would have to, like local school districts would have to raise property taxes to cover budget shortfalls?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kirk Carpenter, the calculation, the mechanism associated with this particular bill is that the students are all enrolled at the school. A child decides to seek the provisions of the potential section of law. A student amount is going to be calculated. I believe it's detailed in the fiscal note. It's similar to the bill that we just heard earlier. The school district would then have to continue to have the student enrolled in the future, receive state and local funds, but they would have to direct the student amount back to the state OPI special revenue fund for use by the parent. So the loss of students and the redirection of funds, once again, it's similar that you would have budget authority, but the full amount of revenue would not be available for the public school. A portion of it would be directed into the state special revenue fund. Is there potential for the need to increase districts'
budget, over base levy to make up for the difference. There's a potential that that could happen, so that what may occur there is a district can go out and ask for an over base levy to increase their over base authority to make up for the loss of revenue. So it's a possibility. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, the way you just explained that to me, the way I'm hearing you, potentially a student could still also be receiving special education resources from their local school because they're still enrolled, but then there would also be this additional funding that would be housed at the Office of Public Instruction that the parent would then be able to spend for things? Is that what I'm hearing from you?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kerr Carpenter, although the student is counted as enrolled for AMP purposes, the student is not actually attending at the school. And so the amount of funding associated with the enrolled, non-enrolled, the enrolled student who counts for A and B purposes that doesn't actually attend at the school district, that student amount is directed into the state special revenue fund. So would they be permitted to attend the school to receive special education benefits? I can't say that with any kind of true conviction as a fiscal analyst, but I would believe that if a student is not attending at an educational site, I can't definitively speak to that.
That's totally fine. Okay, and then one other quick question. The way that I read this bill, we talk about it as like a trust fund housed at OPI, but it's an individual trust for each individual student, correct? Is there any other trust that you've seen in your career as a fiscal analyst that is set up in that way with a tiny bit of amount of money for a specific person that we administer as the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carr Carpenter, I am not aware of any at this time.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Majority Leader Benton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate your time this afternoon. I was fortunate when my son with special needs was entering high school. I had my choice of schools to send him to. And my husband and I carefully vetted the schools in our community and quickly realized that the one that he was supposed to go to was not a good fit. Fortunately, a neighboring school district was a good fit and allowed our son to attend there, where he was very successful. Not every family has that opportunity, has that ability to take their child from one school to another, and this bill allows that to happen. I don't understand why we should fund public schools on the backs of children with special needs. That's not what they're there for. They're there to be educated. And if they're not going to fit into that school for whatever reason, if it's not the best placement for them, then those funds should go with that student to where they can receive the best education to help them reach their full potential, as is stated in our Constitution. So I thank you for this discussion today, and I urge you to pass on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the hearing on House Bill 393. Without objection, we will adjourn until 8 o'clock in the morning.